Constantinople.
So what I'd like to do this evening is just paint a basic picture of the sovereignty of God in history. And we're going to start off with three scriptures. We might get a few more, but we'll just start off with three. The first one, but the first thing I need to do, I suppose, is to follow on from the message from last Sunday. It seems like more than just a week ago. We were speaking about covenant and the whole concept of God desiring to reach out to all people, and he chose one nation. So God's purpose has always been for the entire world, not just for the nation of Israel, but he chose the nation of Israel to be at the centerpiece of his plans and purposes. So it's important to lay that foundation at the very beginning for us to understand God's heart is for all people. Because sometimes when you speak on the subject matter, someone might walk away at the end and think, well, he's only interested in the Jewish people or Israel. No, that's not the case, because it's not God's heartbeat. God's heartbeat is for Jewish and Gentile people all to come to know him. But tonight we're just going to focus upon some of his plans and purposes working through history in relationship to the nation of Israel, but also to the role that Gentile nations have played in helping to bring about the restoration of modern Israel. So the first scripture is from Deuteronomy 32, and my translation says in verse 8, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob is the place of his inheritance. So when the Most High divided the inheritance to the nations, he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. It's interesting that when the Jewish people began to offer sacrifices at the tabernacle and they had the feasts, during the Feast of Tabernacles, they would bring bullocks throughout the entire feast, and at the end of the feast they would have sacrificed 70 bullocks, and they believed that was intercession for the nations. Okay, 70, how many people of Israel went down into Egypt? Okay, about 70. Okay, so the rabbis have sort of come out with this idea that the sacrificing of the bullocks was to do with intercession for the nations. So there's a play on words there. Might have been more than 70 nations at that time, but it's just a symbolic number, you might say. So there is this dynamic, even way back there, of a role between Israel and the nations. And then we go to something which Paul said. It's over in Acts chapter 17. And Paul was probably the greatest evangelist that there was in the early church. Person who would go out and try to introduce Jesus to people, whether they were Jewish or Gentile, it didn't really matter to Paul. He went to the Jew first, and then he also went to the Gentile. But he was always looking for doors of opportunity. But he came to Athens, and at one stage he just could not find the right opportunity to share the message, to introduce Jesus to the people in that particular area. It's called the Areopagus. And then it says in verse 22 of chapter 17, and Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. See, Paul was looking for a natural opportunity. As I mentioned earlier on, how we have anniversary events, they are natural opportunities for us. So Paul, he was looking for a natural opportunity, a springboard, you might say, into the hearts of the people who were there. And when he saw that altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, he knew, this is my open door. And this is what he said. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing him, I proclaim to you. God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. Now, verse 26. And he has made from one blood, that is Adam, every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. So folks, don't feel so bad that you sent us down there. It was destined to happen. Okay? I don't mind that you put my 9-year-old great-great-grandfather in prison as a 9-year-old, okay? For transportation. I'm glad he went down there. God had it all in hand. And I often say to Aboriginal people when I'm speaking in Australia, I say, well, God knew that at one stage in history you would come there, but he also knew one time in history the white people would also come to Australia. It's part of God's bigger plans. Even though the white people didn't always act so nicely down there, white people, black people, have never acted nicely throughout history. It's just the nature of man, because we're all from Adam in the first place. But there's a principle here, God's sovereignty. He knew full well that from one black man, every nation of men, would dwell on all the face of the earth, and God has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Now, what do you think Paul might have been reading in his morning devotions that day? We might have just read it, right? Deuteronomy 32. There's a strong similarity there. But what's the purpose of these nations being there? I mean, this is history. Okay? God knows where these nations will be, when they will be there, and the boundaries of their dwellings. That's history. Because boundaries change. Nations come, nations go. It's all part of history. God is somehow sovereign over everything. But what's the purpose of these nations being where they are? What's the purpose of the nation of Israel being back in the land of Israel now? Paul then goes on, verse 27. So that they should seek the Lord. That's it. So that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Verse 29. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Truly these times of ignorance God overlooked. But now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. So Paul here is basically opening up this perspective that God is sovereign over the nations, yet God's greatest desire is that all men would repent. So it's not one to the detriment of the other. And that's what we need to sort of somehow keep in focus. The third scripture I'm just going to read is from Isaiah chapter 11. Starting off in verse 1. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Ishai, or Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. Who will this be speaking about, you think? I think we all believe it's Jesus, okay? Many others who read Isaiah 11 probably wouldn't see Jesus there, but we see this is all about Jesus. Go over the page. Verse 10. And in that day there shall be a root of Yishai, Jesse. He shall stand as a banner to the people, for the Gentiles shall seek him, and his resting place shall be glorious. Now it's pretty obvious that this is speaking about the same person that we spoke about or read about in verse 1. But what's interesting here is this root of Yishai, this root of Jesse, shall stand as a banner to the people, and the Gentiles shall seek him. Now the word banner in Hebrew is nes. Now, many times, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, so don't go walking away and ask me questions afterwards about Hebrew. I only know a few of these technicalities. But like many English words, a word can actually have several meanings. And the word nes is one of those. One of the If you were in Israel today, and Anne can back me up, if somebody said to you, as a Ness, okay, it's not Nescafe, it's not Loch Ness, it means miracle. As a Ness, what a miracle. Okay? And so put that back into here, because that's what the Hebrew word is, Ness, who shall stand as a Ness to the people, who shall stand as a miracle. Okay? So what do you do with a miracle? Do you hide it under the table? Generally speaking, what do? You should lift it up and hide just like a banner. So you can see why they use the word banner, ensign, flag. It's something to be lifted up on high. Jesus is a miracle all the way through. His birth, his life, his ministry, his death and resurrection, his ascension. It's all miraculous. But who are we? For those who believe in him, who are we? Aren't we in? We're in covenant with Jesus, so who are we? We're also miracles, because we've gone from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, like that. Have we done anything about it? No, it's all by grace, God's grace. So, in a sense, we're walking around carrying that banner as well. But let's just look at Jesus. He is a banner. He is someone who should be lifted up on high. So, let's look at another scripture following straight on from that. It says, verse 11, "It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamat and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." We'll just leave it there. So using that same word, Ness, what's happening here? This second restoration of the nation of Israel back to the land, God desires it will be set up as a banner for the nations, as a miracle. It should be lifted up on high, yet unbelievably, many within the church hide it, trample on it, throw it out. But it should be lifted up on high. It's not to say that Israel is perfect, and I think I mentioned that as well last week. Israel's far from perfect, and we should never worship Israel, all Jewish believers in Jesus, all Jewish people. We should stand away from that. It's idolatry. But we should acknowledge the fact that God keeps his covenant promises, which have been sealed with an oath, and this is a testimony. So when we see Israel restored in the land, we should be saying, this is a testimony that God keeps those covenant promises which have been sealed with an oath. It's all about God's character. The modern restoration of Israel to the land is a miracle. Whichever way you look at it, geopolitically, militarily, economically, socially, it's a miracle. It really should not be there. But it is there. And it's not because of the Zionist movement. You can go to some Zionist meetings, some Jewish meetings, and they'll go on about this and that, whatever else, and you think, oh, it all came about because they were smarter and better and got it all done. Well, they're very smart, very good, but they didn't get it all done. It's not the way God works. He never allows any individual, entity, institution to do it all. Because what happens when that happens? Pride comes in, and something about pride and fall, isn't there? And I've known it in my own life. When I got up myself, guess what? Next thing I know, I'm down the ground. And I'm sure many of us experience that as well. In God's great sovereignty, he's allowed this modern day miracle, the nation of Israel in the land of Israel, to be brought about by the involvement of so many different individuals, institutions, entities, nations and empires, that not one could take the credit. And it's not just Jewish people, because the foundations of this modern day restoration were primarily laid by Gentiles. Not just Christians. Many Christians, yes, but Gentiles, many of whom were not followers of Jesus, but they thought they were doing something or other for their own imperial egoistic goals. And at the end of it, what did they do? They furthered God's purposes for the restoration of Israel. Dear old Kaiser Wilhelm II just being one of them, okay? He thought he was doing a good thing by joining up with the Turks. Oh, he did us a good service, because as a result of the Kaiser joining up with the Turks in 1898, what did that mean? When the First World War came along, there was an alliance between Germany and Turkey, which therefore gave us the right, so to speak, Australia, New Zealand, Britain, to invade Palestine. And if you're going to take territory, you have to do something with it. Somebody has to govern. Who's going to govern that strategic piece of real estate? Situated between Britain there and India here, we need to make sure that it's an ally to us. Who's it going to be? The Jewish people. And guess who was wanting to be restored back there as a nation at that very time? The Jewish people. Okay, so all things work together, ultimately, for his purposes. Hey, no human being could have written that. Doesn't matter how smart Benjamin Disraeli was. I think he was pretty smart. He got a loan of £4 million from the Rothschild family to purchase the majority shares of the Suez Canal Company. That's pretty smart. But not even he would be smart enough to put all this together. Of the Turks joining with the Germans. What I'm going to attempt to do today is to show how some events happen on the same day, 31st of October, which in some incredible way are actually all interrelated. That's the subject of the documentary we're working on now, and Hugh and I have had the pleasure for the last week of working on this, and we're planning to have it ready for next year, to present it there, for people to be able to see the sovereignty of God in history. The 31st of October, Destiny's Day. The first date is 1517. The 31st of October, 1517. What happened then? Any ideas? Luther. Okay, now you may not be a great fan of Luther, and many Jewish people most definitely aren't fans of Luther, because some years later he wrote a terrible book called The Jews and Their Lies. However, what Luther did was actually nail his 95 theses on the church door in Wittenberg. He actually made a declaration. Now, he wasn't the only reformer. There were many, many other reformers as well, okay, from a whole range of different countries. But still, that event is classified as Reformation Day. It's one event which people say, yep, he staked something on the door. It was more than just 95 theses. It was an open challenge to the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. And that's what we need to concentrate upon. So what that did is it basically unlocked a whole lot of doors. One of the doors that unlocked was the reading of Scripture. So as a result of the Reformation associated with the 31st of October 1917, people in Germany and elsewhere now had access to the Scriptures. Now I need to just make a little sideline here about Germany and German Christians and Lutherans. Many people think they're all bad and anti-Semitic, etc., etc. But that's not the case. There was a stream of evangelicalism within the Lutheran Church, and they're called Pietists, the Pietist movement. There's one guy called Philip Spener, for instance. Towards the latter part of the 1600s, sometime after Luther, but nevertheless, he was the leader basically of the evangelical movement in Germany at the time, a bit like Wesley, you might say. And he influenced a number of people to have a favourable attitude towards Jewish people. And as a result of his ministry, a few other institutions were established. In Halle, for instance, the city of Halle, there was an institutum called the Institutum Judaicum, established in the 1730s. And this institute had a very positive attitude towards Jewish people and used to send folks out to go into Jewish communities and to introduce Jesus to people in Jewish communities all over Central Europe. An incredible work. Went on for about 60 or 70 years, Institutum Judaicum. And John Kahlenberg was the man who headed up that work. And there was another man called Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf, who also was, in a sense, a disciple of Philip Spener. And, you know, the work of the Moravian Church, the Herrenhutters, okay, they also had a very favourable attitude towards Jewish people. So there were things happening, and there was a stream within that evangelical movement, to such a point that at the end of the 1700s, there was a young Jewish man called Joseph Levi. He was in a carriage one day going between one city and another in Germany. And this young Jewish man was trying to keep the kashrut, the dietary laws. And he couldn't do it. He's getting frustrated. Sitting opposite him was a man. He was either a pietist or he was a Moravian. He was observing what this young Jewish man was trying to do. And at one stage he said something to him like, there is actually another way. Now let me point to you Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34, and the promise of the new covenant. And this German pietist, Moravian Christian, read out to him, Jeremiah chapter 31, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will cut a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Well, that cut this man's right down here, okay? He couldn't walk away from having heard that testimony. He was never the same again. In actual fact, he soon came to a personal relationship with Jesus. He was baptized and his name was changed to Joseph Frey. Joseph Frey, a few years later, came over here to work with the London Missionary Society, and he saw the plight of Jewish people in the East End of London. He asked the London Missionary Society for permission not to go to South Africa, but to stay and to work amongst those Jewish people. Permission was given, and as a result of this, an organisation was finally birthed in London in 1809 called the London Jews Society. It's still functioning today. Today it's called CMJ. And one of the first vice presidents of the London Jews Society was none other than William Wilberforce. Okay, to give you some idea, and he wasn't the only one. Okay, the early vice presidents and leaders was a bit like the who's who of evangelical Christianity of the time. Everybody in this country was interested in this subject matter of the time. But you cannot look at the beginning of this movement here without going back and realizing, well, a lot of it had to do with one Jewish man. And he was influenced by that stream within German evangelicalism, which actually had an impact upon his life. Very interesting that in that period of time, many of the missionary societies that were established in this country, and there were lots of them, were short-staffed. And a lot of the people that came to work with these missionary societies came from Germany. There was an incredible symbiotic relationship that was going on in that time. And so when this organisation began, there were other organisations, but initially it was the only organisation, it provided a platform in this country for anybody, Anglican, non-Anglican, Baptist, you name it. There was one guy called James Bisschenaux. He was a Baptist minister, Reverend James Bisschenaux. He wrote a profound book, he wrote several actually, prophetic in the 1790s and the early part of the 1800s. So those people from a whole range of different denominational backgrounds were interested in the subject matter of the Jewish people and their restoration, their full restoration, not just to the land, but to their Messiah, to the Messiah. Now, where did these people get this awareness from? From reading the scriptures. The scriptures came about because of the revivals that were happening, all part of the Reformation. And so you see all these connections all the way through. So we have an event happening within the European church, as well as here, which is people going back to the scriptures and seeing that God had not forsaken the Jewish people, that there was a responsibility upon us, the church, to introduce Jewish people to Jesus, but many of these people also believed that the nation was going to be restored, as we read about just a while ago in Isaiah 11, would be restored to the land. Okay? A second restoration, you might say. And this would be part of God's bigger plan, which ultimately would result in the return of Jesus to Jerusalem. So it wasn't one to the detriment of the other. It was to take Jesus out to the Jewish people, but God was also going to take them back to the land. So let's ask the question. When the people in the early 1800s in this country were beginning to develop this theology that one day the Jewish people would go back, how optimistic do you think they were if they looked at the geopolitical scene at the time? You'd have to be a real optimist when you realise that that area is under the control of the Ottoman Turks. What chance have you got of the Ottoman Turks one day saying, oh yes, I know that the Jewish people are going to come back, we'll just let that land be open up for them. Do you think that's going to happen? No. Okay, we're going to be realistic. So if it's going to happen, if the Ottoman Turkish Empire was going to, I wouldn't say allow, but if the Jewish restoration was going to happen within this geopolitical context, it would require a
miracle.
Yeah, a war as well. As part of it. Well, okay, yeah. I'm staying with this lady. I've got to. I've got to make sure I keep on the right side of these two. That war was part of it. Yes, sir. But it's a miracle, folks. Only a miracle would allow a situation to develop whereby the Jewish nation could go back. On several levels. The Jewish people then weren't even wanting to go back. Are you aware of that? The early 1800s, the Jewish people did not want to go back. A few did. But generally speaking, the rabbis weren't allowing that. They weren't in favour of it. Because the rabbis, they actually were clamping down on all messianic ideas and pretenders and so on and so forth. Plus they believed that when the Messiah came, or comes, he would bring the people back. But all those things began to change. From the 1800s through the 1850s, slowly, slowly things began to happen. Whereby Jewish people began to realise, oh, things are getting difficult in Europe. We need a safe haven. And it was no longer the influence of what we call ecclesiastical anti-Semitism that brought those people to that point. It was the beginning of what we call nationalistic anti-Semitism. As nationalism began to rise in Europe, new nations were coming into existence, things were unleashed, and people were looking around to make sure he's got to be a good Frenchman. He wants to be living in France. He's got to be a good German. He's got to be a good this and a good that. And who was not quite fitting in to being good Germans or good French? The Jewish people. Okay, so nationalism began to bring forth a new type of anti-Semitism. And there were Jewish intellectuals who were beginning to see that. And they could see, aha, there's danger signs. It's no longer the church. Something else is going on. And towards the end of the 19th century, there was a man called Theodor Herzl who summated that. But there were others before him. But we're jumping the gun. Just to let you know that in the 1800s, it was not the Jewish people themselves who were agitating to go back to the land. It was the Christians at that stage who wanted to see the Jewish people go back to the land. There were so many Christians in the early 1800s that believed in this concept that if you go to the British Library and just start looking for the pamphlets, the sermons and the books, you'd be there for a month of Sundays. I was there for quite a while, and I only just skimmed the surface, you might say. It's quite amazing. A lot of things were happening in the country in that period of time. Interestingly, at the same period of time, when the evangelical missionary societies were being birthed, you had this interest in the Jewish people and them going back to the land. It's all to do with revival. Whenever there's a revival, people go back to the scriptures. Okay? And that's what was happening. The Christians were the ones who could see that, according to the word of God, the Jewish people would go back to the land. They were the ones who got on board. It's not just a matter of getting on board to be actively involved, it was also getting on board through prayer. You see, when the Jewish people went back after the first exile, we have a few recorded instances of Nehemiah and of Daniel as being intercessors. Now, there must have been more, but we have two mentioned. Well, in the modern period, there was more than two. All you need to do is look through the periodicals of the CMJ, for instance. I've had the pleasure to do that. And you'll see people all over Britain and Ireland were actually receiving information and were praying. You have a prayer for Israel in your church now. Okay, and that's fantastic. Please do not stop. Please keep it going. But that sort of prayer initiative was happening all over Britain and Ireland way back then. People just reading this stuff and say, right, let's pray into it. So there were intercessors everywhere. Not just a Daniel or a Nehemiah, but many Daniels and many Nehemiahs. And guess what? When people began to pray, things began to happen. It was in that period of time that Napoleon Bonaparte invaded the Middle East. The whole reason for Napoleon being there was he wanted to defeat the British in India. So he said, I'll go to the Middle East. Work that one out. Well, let's think about it. France is very close to Egypt. So his idea was to get down, capture Egypt, cut a canal to connect the Mediterranean with the Red Sea, get his ships through there, either overland or through a canal, sail them down, and while you Brits were eating your cucumber sandwiches and drinking your afternoon cup of tea, suddenly the French would roll up. Bang, you wouldn't even know they were coming. Right? That was the whole idea. Get down to India and the Brits wouldn't know we're on the way. Clever thinking. But Admiral Nelson was cleverer than Napoleon. They caught up with him and sunk his fleet. And so Napoleon couldn't continue on with his quest. He was stranded. But then he went up into what was known as Palestine at the time and tried to capture that land. He failed. But while he was there in 1799, Napoleon, he was clever still, even though he'd been defeated, he's still clever. He realized that to succeed in his goal, he would need allies. The Maronite Christians were allies because the Catholics protected the French protected the Catholics in the region. But he saw the Jewish people as also being a potential ally. But what was going to be the carrot that he would offer to the Jewish people for them to be sympathetic towards French intentions? A restoration. So he supposedly made a proclamation. The original has never been found, but excerpts soon found their way into French and then later British newspapers. So I believe something was actually stated by Napoleon. Although it must be said, the original has never been found. So, Napoleon saw the connection between the Jewish people, the return to the land of Israel, and his own imperial plans and policies. Now, does that ring a bell for 1917? It should do. Because that's the reason Britain was in that region in 1917, and that's the reason why the Balfour Declaration was enacted. Okay? Because it's all to do with geopolitics, it's all to do with economics, it's all to do with trade. Above it all is God's sovereign purposes, but down here at this level, that's what it was all about. Now, people might have had their own ambitions and desires, and God was probably just saying, okay, you go ahead and do it. But at the end, you're going to be fulfilling my purposes. So anyhow, Napoleon failed. But what that did is it triggered off two reactions within Britain. One was political. The British government now realised they have a problem, a big problem, a major problem. How easily a rival European power could cut their connection to India. We need to keep an eye on those French, I was going to say something else there, but those French, yes, how dare I say that? I'm not even a Brit. We've got to keep an eye on the French, but we also have to keep an eye on the Russians, because you see, the Russians could quite easily come down from the Black Sea through the Bosphorus, Dardanelles, and they didn't have far to go. So we have to keep an eye on what the French and the Russians are doing, to keep them away from the area of the Middle East. Why? Was Britain that interested? No. It's because the Middle East was halfway between Britain and India. And don't forget now you had my convict relatives down there as well. We had to look after them too. So the empire was growing. So Britain had to make sure the link, the trade link, was secure. Now folks, all that began straight after Napoleon's invasion. So this is hard for you, but please, can we just give a clap for the French? Hey, listen, they had the idea, you just came in and stole the idea. So the Suez Canal, they built it, you just came in later and, you know, took it over. So come on. Anyhow, but are you beginning to grasp something? It's quite intricate, complicated, and I don't understand it all, but I understand enough to realise there's something quite amazing happening here. So that's the first reaction from Britain, was on the political level. The second one was on the Christian level, because so many Christians were looking at these events and were thinking, oi, voy, voy, this is interesting. I just read through Isaiah 11 this morning for my quiet time. And then I pick up the time for the Guardian. Not as pro-Israel papers. Right? I just picked up one of the newspapers and I read about Napoleon going in. I read about Nelson coming in. And then I begin to see towns like Gaza, Jaffa, Akko. Those are the towns. Jerusalem wasn't mentioned because so much because Napoleon didn't go there. But towns that are in the Bible, and I'm reading them in the newspaper. And then my own nation sends in a military force and defeats Napoleon at the Battle of Akko in May of 1799. I read about those places in the Bible, and now I'm reading about them in the newspaper. And then I hear about this proclamation, supposed proclamation of Napoleon for the Jewish people to go back. And I'm thinking, French doing that? They don't even believe in God. They kicked him out. If any nation is going to be the modern day Cyrus nation, it's going to be our nation. And folks, that actually began to be a sentiment that was birthed in the first decade of the 1800s. I'm not saying everybody believed it, but enough did. But sometimes you don't need everybody. You just need enough who can carry on and carry it through. So that was what was happening in the decade in which this organisation, CMJ, was birthed, which Joseph Frey came. So that was the environment that was happening. So once you had this platform, people just came onto that platform and it continued to grow. And in time, other institutions, other organisations were established as well. Geopolitically, though, the land of Israel was still part of the Turkish Empire. Part of what they call Dar al-Islam. So it's still going to require a miracle if that's going to happen. Now, again, I don't want to go into all the details. If you are interested, it's in the stuff that's written, it's on the DVDs. But there were lots of things happening in the 1900s. Shifts of interest, you might say. One empire with, let's say, might have been Russia and France together on this occasion, and then later it was Britain came in to oppose one of them. It was a whole change of alliances. But throughout the 1800s, there was one constant, and that was Britain remained allied or an alliance to Turkey. Because Britain realised it was important to have a strong Turkey. If Turkey got weak, the other empires might come in and begin to gobble up the Turkey. Could have been France, could have been Russia. So what would happen if either the French or the Russians came in, because Turkey was getting weak, and took over areas? That would cause Britain to have to be involved in the affairs of the Middle East. And Britain wasn't looking to be involved in the affairs of the Middle East. So let's keep Turkey strong, and let's keep ourselves, Britain, allied to Turkey. Now, we can understand that. All that was going along fairly nicely until the Germans decided to defeat the French in the Franco-Prussian War. This created a new dynamic. Okay, so Suez Canal had just been built, 1869, Franco-Prussian War came the next year, 1871, Germany is created as a new empire. So now there's a new kid on the block. So now Britain, she thought with the French being defeated, that's okay, we don't have to worry about the French anymore, but now Germany gets on the scene and now Britain has to keep an eye on Germany. So, therefore, that's the period of time when Disraeli came in and purchased the majority shares of the Suez Canal Company. See, when the French built the Suez Canal, it was a real danger sign for Britain, as you can imagine. But when Disraeli purchased the majority shares, the government could go, pressure's off. Right? We've now got the Suez Canal. But they realised, what happens if somebody takes control of Egypt or somebody takes control of Palestine? They're right next to the Suez Canal. They would effectively be able to throttle us. So, 1882, Britain took over control of Egypt. Now they thought, wow, we've got Egypt under our wing, you might say. But in the back of their minds, there was also the other side, which was the Sinai and Palestine. But they were content with just having control over Egypt. France might have gone down after the Franco-Prussian War, but then who began to rise? Germany now began to rise, okay? And that was beginning to be a problem. So from the 1880s onwards, Germany became more and more involved in the affairs of the region. Russia was always there. Russia was sort of in the wings. Russia had always had a desire to have control over the Bosphorus, which is Constantinople, and the Dardanelles. Russia had always coveted that region because it wanted to be able to have an outlet from the Black Sea into the big wide world. And that, folks, is still reality until today. And so all these things were happening. Okay, Russia was there. France is weaker. Germany's beginning to rise. Turkey's tottering. It's getting weaker. Britain's trying to do what it can to help Turkey stay afloat or alive. And Britain is thinking, well, there's a few problems around. We've got to really keep an eye on matters. So then we get to the end of the 1800s. And I'm simplifying a very, very big picture here. We get to the end of the 1800s. And there's a man called Theodor Herzl, a Jewish man. And he began to observe, because he actually was from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he was observing what was happening inside the Austro-Hungarian Empire and realizing that if the Austro-Hungarian Empire fell and national entities came into prominence, it would be disastrous for Jewish people because they were always scapegoats. Always through history they've been a scapegoat. And he realized the scapegoats would be the Jewish people. Okay. There was an incident in France in about 1894 or so as well, but generally speaking, Theodor Herzl recognized danger signs for Jewish people. So he wrote a book called The German Start, in which he said the Jewish people need to go back to Palestine. And so that was the agenda. And others now began to realize, yes, we agree with you. Now is the time. And so they began to agitate for going back. Now, where would they go back to again? At the time it was called Palestine. Under whose control was Palestine? Turkey, Islamic. The Sultan of Turkey was also the Caliph of Islam. So, if this is going to happen, if the Jewish people are going to go back in mass to the land of Israel, they would actually need to have favour with the Sultan. Well, do you think Mr. Herzl would have any chance he went to meet with the Sultan? No, so there needs to be a mediator. There needs to be an entity by which the Jewish people could go to and say, we need some help from you. Can you please speak to the Turkish Sultan on our behalf? Who do you think that would be at the end of the 1890s? Okay, hands up those who think Britain. All right, hands up who think might be somebody else. You know, you can be quiet. Who else do you think it could be? I'll give you a hint. The Germans. Right? The Germans. Why? Because the Zionist movement was a central European movement. Okay? There were some Brits involved, but mostly, some Anglos, but mostly it was coming from Europe, from Germany. Yes, you're right there. Okay? Germany, Europe, there weren't that many German Jews who were really into it because they were so assimilated by that stage. But there were some who were. And so, yes, they really thought, no, it's going to have to be the Germans who will speak on our behalf. And so, right at that time, under the period of Kaiser Wilhelm II, the Germans wanted to establish an economic relationship with Turkey. They wanted to expand. What's it called again in German? Lebensraum or something like that? But they realized they couldn't do that in Turkey, but they needed to have economic expansion. So they wanted to enter into a political and economic relationship with Turkey. So it was decided that in 1898, the German Kaiser would go to meet with the Sultan of Turkey to begin to establish this relationship on a strong, solid foundation. And then he would continue on to Palestine, because the Germans who had begun at Christchurch, which belonged to CMJ in the 1800s, the Germans had now built their own church. An incredibly big church right in the middle of Jerusalem. Yes. Prime real estate. How'd they get that? Well, the Sultan wasn't. He was smart also. He was looking for a European nation that he could rely upon. He couldn't trust the British, the French or the Russians, and he was looking for a European nation that he could work with, and he saw Germany. So he gave it some prime real estate in the middle of the old city of Jerusalem. So by 1898, that real estate had turned into a magnificent church, and it was going to be opened by the Kaiser. Who else? On what day do you think this new church would be opened? 31st of October. Why? Reformation Day. And so the visit of the Kaiser ostensibly was to open this new German church, which would be a symbol of a relationship between Germany and Turkey. You see, when something happens in Jerusalem, everybody takes note. And so the thing he wanted to get over was, Germany has arrived, take note, look at our magnificent big building. More than that, Germany and Turkey are entering into a relationship. So, it was all set out. The Germans were on the way. So they go to Constantinople. The Zionist movement said, here's our chance. And so what they did is Herzl followed the Kaiser to Constantinople and had a meeting with him and gave a plea on behalf of the Jewish people. Can you please speak to the Sultan? It's late. I've been with Hugh for a whole week. Forgive me. Can you please speak to the Sultan on our behalf, said the Zionist movement. Ask for a land charter so that Jewish people can go back and settle. We have to purchase land, you're not going to get it, so we can actually have the chance to purchase land. And so that is what the Kaiser did. But what do you think the Sultan, it's not recorded exactly as far as I found yet what the Sultan said, but we know afterwards from the reaction from Herzl, what do you think the Sultan of Turkey, who's the Caliph of Islam, would have said about this? The Turkish version of no. Okay? Which is the same as the German word for nein. And so, there's no chance. There's no way. From Germany's perspective, and I'm sure this is what some of the advisors would have been saying to the Kaiser, if we, as Germany, want to establish this relationship with Turkey, there's no way in the world we at the same time can be championing the Jewish cause. It's either one or the other. So can you understand that dynamic? Yeah. So when this news came back to Herzl and the Zionists, they were, of course, quite upset. And didn't happen straight away, but then they realised we need somebody else. Who was the somebody else? Who was second off the rank?
Britain.
But it took a few years. Why? Because Britain wasn't willing, the government wasn't really willing at that stage to enter into this relationship with the Jewish people. Because Britain still wanted to have a strong Turkey. Britain still needed to have Turkey strong in order to make sure that they were allied to a strong Turkey, to make sure the trade link between Britain and India particularly was healthy and strong. So things were still going to have to happen. But it's interesting, in that same period of time, 1902, I believe it was, a man called Arthur James Balfour, had just become Prime Minister. And in that period of time, already the government was beginning to look at the Suez Canal region and all these different things that were going on. The Russians were agitating, the French were getting active again, the Germans were there. Oi, voy, voy, we might still have a problem. And in about 1903, Hugh, correct me if I'm wrong there, about 1903, a proposal was made to establish a Jewish colony in the Sinai. Because the Sinai was actually under British jurisdiction. It was regarded as being under the government of Egypt. So a Jewish colony in the Sinai, on the other side of the Suez Canal. A Jewish colony under British protection. That sounds pretty good. Good for the Jews, the Jewish people. They couldn't get Palestine, but at least they could have a colony, which was pretty close. A stepping ground, perhaps. So negotiations then actually began. But they fell through. But still, you can see that everything's going step by step. Things are beginning to happen. But it will take another decade before things really happen. So there we have a bit of a picture. It could be confusing. Have I confused you? It's a pretty complicated though. Britain is still allied to Turkey. Britain wants Turkey to be strong. But it's now wary of all these other entities, particularly the Germans. The Germans built a railway, ultimately, all the way down to Baghdad. Berlin to Baghdad. They're involved in the railway being built. First to Istanbul, and then another one down to Baghdad. What they wanted to do was to continue their railway down to the mouth of the Persian Gulf, which means all the produce from the Far East didn't have to go through the Suez Canal. They could just come up through the Persian Gulf, get into a German train, chuff, chuff, chuff. A week or so later, it ends up in Berlin. The Brits thought, oi, smart cookies, these Germans. They could still do it. So all these things were part and parcel of what was happening in that time. But things were getting closer as well. Britain then entered into political relations with the French. Yeah, it happened in 1906. Then 1907 with the Russians. So now you had Britain, France and Russia, who had been opposed to each other throughout the previous years, 100 years almost, were now together. Why did they all come together? Because of Germany. Okay, because they could see that Germany was going to become a threat. And the Germans weren't interested in just, you know, allowing spheres of interest. They were interested in just developing their own interest in the Turkish Empire. So we get to the period of 1914. Britain is still allied to Turkey. The First World War comes along, and the Germans, clever cookies, they actually entered into a formal alliance with the Turks 2 days before the war began. A secret alliance. It wasn't known about, but they entered into a secret alliance. Many of the Turkish leaders actually they didn't know, and they didn't want this to happen because they either wanted to remain neutral or ally to the British. But now it happens. Germany and Turkey are now officially together. So what does that mean when the First World War began? Britain is fighting against Germany. Who else is it fighting against? Turkey, even though they didn't know it at the time. That only became obvious in October when some Russian ships were being bombed in the Black Sea. So now we have a complete change of scenario. The miracle, folks, is getting closer. Turkey is still in control. But now because of the war situation, we find Britain, France and Russia and us, don't forget us, we were there as well, you couldn't have done it without us. Okay, the colonies, we were there. We are now fighting against Germany and the Turkish Empire. So, then you get into the Gallipoli campaign and the conflict gets very, very close. It's actually now on Turkish territory. But the Turks defeated us at Gallipoli. And so next thing, we came back to Egypt. The Turks won at Gallipoli. Who did the Turks beat, incidentally, at Gallipoli? They beat us, yes. That's okay. Who else? Britain. The Turks defeated Britain. Right, that's not a small thing. That's a big thing. From the side of the Turks, it's a big thing. They've got the Brits on the run. So what do you think they're going to try to do now? They're in a victorious state.
Germany.
Germany's already in. Yeah. From a military perspective, what would be a major goal for the Turks? And, close to it, the Suez Canal. Okay. If they could capture the Suez Canal, they could effectively throttle the connection between Britain and the Empire. So that's what they attempted to do. So our next goal from the side of the Allies was to protect the Suez Canal. So here we have the Suez Canal, right out, up here. There's the Suez Canal. On the west side is Egypt. Over here is Sinai. And then Israel, the land of Israel. So if we're going to protect the Suez Canal, we have to be on this side. If the Turks want to get to the Suez Canal, they have to come through the Sinai. So in 1916, the goal was to capture the Sinai. Okay? Or to make sure the Turks never got there. So there was conflict in 1916 over here in the Sinai. So right the way through 1916, there were lots of battles. British, Australian, New Zealand forces were all there. At the end of 1916, we captured the entire Sinai. No more Turkish troops in the Sinai. And the government at the time, Asquith and Gray, said, right, job done. The Suez Canal is now safe. That's it. The boys in the desert can go and play cricket and rugby and soccer and football and Gaelic football and whatever else they want to play now. They've done their job. But then something very interesting happened. There was a change of government. At the very same time that our soldiers captured the Sinai, right up here to a place called El Arish, at the very same time there was a change of government. Asquith and Gray were forced out. The prime ministership was offered to a Canadian. Okay, Andrew Bonar Law. He was actually a Canadian Scot. Ever heard of Andrew Bonar Law? It was offered to him. He deferred. As to know, there's a better man. A man who can actually carry the nation behind him. His name is David Lloyd George. Okay? He deferred to the Scotsman, deferred to a Welshman. There you go. And David Lloyd George brought in a man soon afterwards to be his foreign secretary, or was it Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, to get it correct? I had to go through that one a few times the other day, didn't I, Hugh, to get that right? His name was Arthur James Balfour. So I find quite interesting that at the very time when the soldiers were there, you actually had a government coming in, a change of government coming in. Lloyd George did not really like the French. I don't know how, why. I'm not quite sure exactly what Balfour's opinion was on that particular subject, but Lloyd George wanted to make sure that the French had no interests in this region over here. He realised the only thing to do was not to stop on the border. Is Antigua, does she? No, she's still standing, it's a good sign. So Lloyd George realised the only thing to do is to actually capture the entire region. British forces were here, Australian, New Zealand forces were all here, there were no French troops there, and that's because David Lloyd did not want any French troops here. And it was not taken so well by the French government. There were no French troops here, it was all our troops. There was only Australian, New Zealand and British troops. He said, what we have to do is capture the entire region, right up to Turkey, Mesopotamia, capture it all, and then we're in the best place afterwards to decide who is going to get what. Okay, they're already in negotiations with the Arabs, you might say, with the French, Sykes-Picot Agreement, all those things are already going on. But Lloyd George, I believe on this point, he was far-sighted. Our troops have to capture the entire region. Okay? You might say he's imperialist. Say what you like. From way back then, that was his attitude. And so, that's what they decided to do. So the beginning of 1917, the policy was to capture the land, starting off with Jerusalem. That was the first goal, was to capture Jerusalem. So if you're going to get to Jerusalem, you have to go first to Gaza. That's right on the coast, and there's water. But they failed there. They had two major defeats in March and April 1917. We lost we lost thousands of men. So with that, we realised there had to be a new strategy. We could not capture the land through Gaza. There needed to be another strategy. And we needed another commander. The new commander was brought in called General Edmund Allenby. So he came in. And in the meantime, another general called Philip Chetwode devised a brilliant plan. So just imagine, this is the Sinai over here, this is the land of Israel. There's Gaza right on the coast. Inland from there, there's a town called Beersheba. We call it Beersheba, you call it Beersheba. The Australians call it the place of seven beers. Sheba can also mean beer. Well, Hugh, that's Hugh's one. He gets credit for that one. So Beersheba. Now, what's Beersheba there for? What's the background of Beersheba? First of all, what's it called? What's its name? Okay. Seven Wells, or the Oath of the Well. Beersheba is also Oath. The Oath of the Well. Okay. Who lived there? Abram, Isaac, Jacob lived close by. Okay. And the name itself came because of a covenant that was cut between Abraham and Abimelech. Okay, and that's where the name actually came from. But Abram lived in that area. It's quite interesting. We're now going to have a battle in an area that's associated with the very person to whom God entered into covenant. Very interesting. Inverted commas. So, new commander was coming in. Philip Chetwode handed over to Allaby the plans. He said, that's a great idea. I'll just make a few changes and it'll be called Allaby's plan now, not your plan. But anyhow, that's what happens, isn't it? So the plan now was to capture Beersheba. Now there comes a tricky problem. Who's going to govern the land of Israel? This is not Timbuktu. It's not the Kimberleys of Western Australia. This is the land of Israel. Who's going to govern it? The British government was far-sighted enough to realise that none of her allies would ever allow her, as a Protestant nation, to control the land of Israel, the Holy Land. So none of Britain's allies, not all the Vatican, all the United States, nobody would ever allow Britain to have sole control. The Brits realised that. So she had to devise a plan, she had to come up with a plan which would allow Britain to fulfil her own imperialist policies because she wanted control over that region. Why? To secure the link between Britain and
India.
So Britain had to come up with a plan that could fulfil those purposes but at the same time not upset her allies. Who now comes into the equation? The Jewish People, the Zionist organisation. So it was going to fit in wonderfully. But don't believe it was a dead cinch getting that way. There's a lot of negotiations, a lot of things happening behind the scenes and had nothing to do with Chaim Weizmann inventing acetone, okay? Which is a kindergarten story you all heard. I won't go into the details. There was a lot of very complicated stuff went on behind the scenes thereafter to fulfill that basic desire, to ensure that a plan was devise, which would suit Britain's long-term desires, but would also not upset her allies, particularly the Americans, because they wanted the Americans to now come into the conflict. So very, very intricate negotiations were taking place. Ultimately, it boiled down to a decision that had to be made by the British War Cabinet, and they're going to vote on this proposal from the Jewish organisation. That was a letter through Lord Rothschild to the British government requesting the establishment of the Jewish National Home in Palestine, and that vote would be taken in the War Cabinet meeting on the 31st of October 1917. So that's the first thing. The battle for Beersheba, which would be the crucial battle, because if we didn't win Beersheba, there's no chance we're going to get into the land, because the Turks would then bring down reinforcements, and there were sizable German reinforcements en route. So if we couldn't win at Beersheba, there's virtually no chance we're going to get in, because they would just consolidate that line. So the battle for Beersheba was also going to take place on the 31st of October. So you have two more crucial dates, or crucial events, potentially to happen on the 31st of October. One in London, one in Beersheba. So the end result you all know, okay? The Battle of Beersheba was won. It was a combined effort by British, Australian and New Zealand troops. I have to emphasise this. The British were given certain... Well, I emphasise this because over here, hardly anybody hears about the Australians being there, or the New Zealanders. But down in Australia, they take all the credit for the victory and actually sideline the fact the British were there. So it's a bit of an interesting struggle. But anyhow, challenge. But the British infantry were given certain things to achieve. Allaby gave a plan. You British infantry, you do that. They did it. The Australians and New Zealanders, you do that. The Kiwis, New Zealanders, captured ancient Tel Saba. The ancient Beersheba of Abraham's time was captured by the New Zealanders. Now just imagine that. It's one of the youngest countries in the world, basically. Way down there, population of only a million. And they had the kavod, you might say, of actually capturing the ancient Beersheba. But Beersheba was still not taken. It was late in the afternoon. It was the plan, it was the order for the Australians and New Zealanders to capture Beersheba itself. It hadn't been taken. The sun was going down. The Germans and the Turks were going to blow up all the water wells, which would actually mean thousands of men and thousands of horses would go without water. So it had to be captured in that one day. And so right in the afternoon, the 4th and 12th Australian Light Horse Regiments, between 600 and 800 men on horse, okay, they were infantry on horseback. They weren't cavalry. It's a distinct difference there. They had no swords. They just had their bayonets. They then charged in at the end of the day as the sun was going down and finally captured Beersheba. So by about 6 o'clock, Beersheba was captured on the 31st of October, the first victory. At about the time the charge began, which was approximately 4:30 in the afternoon there, it was about 2:30 in the afternoon in London. And right at that time, the War Cabinet was finishing up their discussion on the proposal by the Jewish people. They took a vote, and apart from one person who actually was against it, they unanimously voted for the establishment, or Her Majesty's government fused with favour the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, or words to that effect. So at almost the same time, you had two events happening, two parts of the world. Events which I believe did, in fact, change history. Because after that military victory, the way was open to Jerusalem, and after that decision by the War Cabinet, 2 days later, Lord Balfour wrote a letter to the Zionist organisation, to Lord Rothschild, putting into effect the decision made the minute, which is in effect the Magna Carta for the future state of Israel. Now when Beersheba was captured, and I'll finish up soon, I've gone over 9 o'clock, I'm sorry about that. When Beersheba was captured, then it was full on to capture the rest of the land. Jerusalem was captured on the 9th of December. On the 11th of December, General Allenby came into Jerusalem, and he did not ride in as a conquering hero. And he walked in not because he made a decision to walk in. It's got nothing to do with Jesus coming in on a donkey. It's because he was told to walk in by his government. Yes, I'm sorry about that. He was told to walk in. All the instructions, everything Allenby did on that day was actually told to him by the War Office. And even King George himself had a thing or two to say. The reason he walked in my opinion, and I think the rest of the information sort of gives credence to that, is he was the propaganda scoop par excellence of the war. What happened when the German Kaiser went to Jerusalem in 1898? The Germans realised that they had an opportunity for exposure. The Kaiser rode into Jerusalem on a big white horse. Everybody saw it. Even the Punch magazine had it there. Full page, okay? The whole world saw this ostentatious entrance of the German Kaiser on his big white horse into Jerusalem. Propaganda scoop, 1898. Propaganda scoop, 1917 is, let's don't do it like the Kaiser did it. Let's do it completely opposite. Let's not even ride in on a horse, white, black, red or yellow. Let's just walk in. Come. In opposition to what the Kaiser did. Who were we fighting in December 1917? And who was in charge of Germany? The same Kaiser. So, an event which happened back in 1898, in October, was now being flip-flopped. And so that's the reason, I believe, personally, that they'd made that decision for Allenby to walk in. No, into Jerusalem. And so that, in a sense, was more or less the end of the campaign. If we captured Jerusalem, it was just a matter of time before we captured the rest of the land. In 1918, our soldiers, Australian, New Zealand, British, and Indian troops, and also the Jewish Legion was now involved. On the other side, there was Faisal and Lawrence and the Arabian Northern Army. We were all involved. We converged upon Damascus. Damascus was captured on the 1st of October. 1918, and then finally fighting ended. The Turkish Empire was defeated completely on the 31st of October 1918, 1 year to the day after we captured Beersheba. Okay, and so there's dates. I do not think that God's up there saying, I'm going to have all these things happen on the 31st of October. No, I don't play that by that. I think they just happened. We've seen that happen. We just have to use them to good effect. Those things happened on the 31st of October, 1517, 1898, 1917, 1918, and we can see there was a connection between all of them. That's all we need to do. We don't need to exaggerate, fabricate, bring in lots of scripture verses. To the best of our ability, bring them together. And just let the ordinary person sit back and hopefully think, I wonder who wrote the master plan. And on that note, I'm going to finish. We've gone past 9 o'clock. If you do have any questions, I'm around for another few minutes. And I'd just like to hand back now. Thank you.